Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia of being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
Justin.
We love all our fans and all the support. If you want to support us back, please go out to genyshop.com. And we have free and premium content out there. We uploaded a personal story from Millie, and we have Tyra Patterson is the premium. So if you go out to the Gen Y shop, you can add the free and the premium content and support us that way. What else we need to cover here?
The premium episode is a way, like Justin said, to support the podcast. It's more of a loose format. We don't have, like, typically our episodes are a certain length of time. These, they could be 30 minutes, they could be an hour. We have no idea. But essentially, you're just supporting the podcast by purchasing it. And on the Tyra Patterson episode, we're donating a portion of the money we receive to the Ohio Justice and Policy Center.
And we'll be putting out new episodes there, but we're just doing something different and trying to give you guys more content, figure out other ways to get support for the show without begging for money. Quick reminder, February 12th, I will be at the V-Bar in San Jose, 5 p.m. till whenever. And then Valentine's Day, February 14th, 1 p.m. at the Victorian Rose Bed and Breakfast in Ventura. And that's my in-laws' bed and breakfast, so don't be crazy. Tonight we have a listener request from Brady.
Yeah, the Oklahoma Girl Scout murders.
And Brady was a winner from our contest.
Right. Let's start off with a summary of this case. Actually, as we record this, I think we're getting into Girl Scout season where they start selling the cookies. Back in 1977 in Oklahoma, there was a large Girl Scout camp known as Camp Scott, and Camp Scott was over 400 acres, and it was named for H.J. and Florence Scott, who were beloved supporters of the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts organizations. This year, as in other years, they would send buses from Magic Empire headquarters, which were the Girl Scout headquarters in Tulsa, to Camp Scott. So there would be about 140 girls plus camp counselors and staff. The very first night they're out there, strange noises are heard. There are stories of people peeking in tents.
Lights in the woods.
Yeah, a dim light in the woods. Then in the morning, a camp counselor heading to the showers discovers a dead girl outside the tents, further inspection will reveal two more dead girls inside of their sleeping bags. And so as you can imagine, this is supposed to be a safe place, a place for girls to have adventures and grow and learn and create friendships. Now there are three dead girls. So a shocking crime in Oklahoma in 1977, June of 1977. It's nearest to Locust Grove, which is about 35 miles east of Tulsa. The families and their girls would gather in Tulsa to say goodbye. The girls were scheduled to go, I believe this camp was for up to 2 weeks. The camp itself is divided into these sections, and each of them are named after a Native American tribe.
The one they're in is called Kiowa.
The one that we'll be focusing on for this episode is the Kiowa camp. So they're getting to camp, and they are assigning girls to these different sections based on their age. And it seems as though every tent is getting four people in it, and every encampment is getting a certain number of counselors to be in the counselor's tent. And so they have the tents numbered, and I'm sure there will be some confusion for anyone that's looked into this case whether this was tent 7 or tent 8. But most people would say this is tent 8 that we'll be referring to most of the time, but it's actually tent 7 because people often will count the counselor's tent as tent 1.
It's the last tent in the row. It's really just the final one. So that's really what you need to keep in mind, not really the number, but just it's the last one.
The Girl Scouts understood also that people had a choice when they would send their kids off to camp. It wasn't just the Girl Scouts that had camps. The Y had camps. Of course, they had promotional materials, and we're able to find a promotional brochure for this Camp Scott. And you look through it, it says, Girl Scouts, this is your camp. Whatever you would like most to do in living in your summer home is possible under the friendly guidance and help of your counselors. Excellent riding and swimming are two of the most popular sports. And they kind of go through and tell you all the things that are possible out there. Remember, it's 410 acres. They have all kinds of things to do. Many people will say after an event like this, it's the death of innocence. Wouldn't you say?
Yeah, especially when it's such young children that are involved in such a heinous crime. I know a lot of the commenters, when we announced this episode, they said that they were in Girl Scouts at the time, or they were thinking about sending their daughters, and after this event they no longer wanted to go camping. They no longer wanted to be out in the wilderness or doing these activities. And that was really sad, because it really put a dark cloud over the Girl Scouts, which it shouldn't have. I mean, they do good stuff, and I think the camp should have stayed open.
There are costs to this, and one of the things that I found interesting was you could visit the camp before it started for the season, and you could meet the counselors and the staff. That was an option. I don't know how many people took advantage of that. Let's talk about Kiowa Camp, because this is the section of the camp where these murders took place. It's said that it's the most remote camp, and that Tent 8 is the most remote tent.
Or secluded. And if you just look at the map of the campsites, it doesn't look that way. It actually just looks like it's at the end of one trail. But I guess from the tree lines and whatever, I guess that's what really makes it isolated. It's just really dense trees back there where it is at.
Dense trees, foliage. And if you're in the counselor's tent, you don't have a good line of sight on tent 8. It's obscured by the showers.
Yeah, it's like the one tent that you can't see. That and being at the end of the row, it's the furthest tent from the counselor's tent.
So this first day, first night, they say that Girl Scouts would show up. They'd meet their tent mates.
Yeah.
They would dine together. They would get settled in. But they also said that they were just so excited that often that first night, many of the girls would stay up pretty late, 1, 2 o'clock sometimes.
And this night, there was a thunderstorm, And I'm sure that probably kept them up because it was pretty loud.
So we talked about how remote this tent is, Tent 8. But there's one more really interesting thing about it, which is there was supposed to be a fourth girl.
Yeah.
In the tent.
It's four girls per tent.
Right. And she ends up being placed in a different tent. It's because of where her birth date is. Her birth date's in December. And they, I don't know if they got their math screwed up or what, but they put her in an older encampment in terms of age. So she was placed with older girls. They actually told her, don't worry, tomorrow we'll move you over to the Kiowa encampment and in Tent 8. But of course, that doesn't end up happening.
And that's probably a stroke of luck for that one individual girl.
So Kiowa, as we said, with that one tent only having three and the other tents having four, there were a total of 27 girls in that encampment that night. And the three girls we'll be talking about are Michelle Gousset, 9, Lori Lee Farmer, Lori was 8, and Doris Denise Milner. Denise was 10. Let's go over the backgrounds of these girls a little bit. Michelle Gousset was really into caring for plants, and her favorite were African violets. Before she left, she actually asked her mother to look after them. She wanted to make sure that they were well-watered and cared for while she was gone. She was at camp the previous year, and she played soccer. So we don't know a ton about these girls. We know a little bit. Lori Lee Farmer was the youngest camper there in the entire camp. She had actually advanced a grade. So while she was probably in the same grade as many of these girls, she wasn't the same age. She was younger. When she was trying to figure out where to go to camp, she wasn't particular on which camp to go to. It could have been Y camp, could have been Girl Scout camp. And her mother said, you're going to Girl Scout camp at Camp Scott. And Denise Milner, this one really stuck with me because she had quite a conversation with her parents. She didn't want to go. Her mother said, well, everyone else is going to camp. You should go to camp. And if after the first night you decide you just don't want to be there, give us a call. We'll come get you. Sort of a compromise. They want to send her, but
get her feet wet. See if it works out.
Because who knows? You want them to go to camp. You want them to have these memories, these experiences. And if she gets there and really likes her tent mates, maybe she'll want to stay. Mm-hmm.
And their camp counselor for Kiowa, her name is Carla Sue. Do we go into the events from that night?
As Justin said, it ends up storming around nightfall, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And at 6 p.m., these girls are in the dining tent eating. At some point, the storm's going to go on throughout the night, probably till around 11 o'clock. And after they're done eating, they wait a little bit and the storm subsides. So I imagine it's sometime after 7, I think, when they leave the dining tent and they go back over to their own tent. One of the things that I've heard as a tradition with Girl Scouts when they're away at camp is each of the girls will write a letter home. And this can be a letter to a family member, a friend.
All three of them write letters.
Michelle Gousset writes a letter to her Aunt Karen. And she writes, Dear Aunt Karen, how are you? I am fine. I am writing from camp. We can't go outside because it is storming. Me and my tent mates are in the last tent in our unit. My tent mates are Denise Milner and Lori Farmer. My room is shades of purple. Love, Michelle. Denise Milner wrote a letter to her mom.
And she was the one that didn't want to go.
She wrote, Dear Mom, I don't like camp. It's awful. The first day it rained, I have three new friends named Glenda, Lori, and Michelle. Michelle and Lori are my roommates. Mom, I don't want to stay at camp for 2 weeks. I want to come home and see Cassie and everybody. Your loving child, Denise Milner. And then I'll read Lori's letter. Dear Mom and Dad and Misty and Joe and Chad and Kathy, we're just getting ready to go to bed. It's 7:45. We're at the beginning of a storm and having a lot of fun. I've met two new friends, Michelle Gousset and Denise Milner. I'm sharing a tent with them. It started raining on the way back from dinner. We're sleeping on cots. I couldn't wait to write. We're all writing letters now because there's hardly anything else to do. With love, Lori. Now, I read that one last, and this is Lori Farmer, the youngest one. It's said that she is really bright. That's why she advanced a grade. And I can tell in this letter that she is, because she gives us really good information here. She gives us the time. She also lets us know that the other girls are writing their letters at the same time. Mm-hmm. So there's no real question here about when they each wrote a letter. And that's brilliant. This is some of the best evidence in the entire case.
Yeah. A few hours later, after writing letters home to their parents, they start hearing noises in the camp and hearing the sound like a bullfrog or some sort of low tone noises.
Well, it's difficult to say because who's giving the reports? Girls that have only been to camp once or have never been to camp before. I'm sure there's wildlife out there, such as cows, such as frogs or whatever else might be out there that they're not used to hearing at home. So it's difficult to know if this is a clue or if it's just regular noises. I know when I used to go up north into Michigan, central Michigan, with my cousin, we would hear really interesting noises. We didn't always know what they were.
I get that, but it was the actual camp counselors that started hearing some of these noises and went to check on the girls, walked around the campsite, and actually saw what they thought was a dim light in the woods. And when Carla said she pointed her flashlight at it, the light went away. And she kept trying to see if it would come back. She heard other noises. And from what I could tell, she was hearing some of the same things that the girls reported.
Well, not only that, she seems to admit that she was a little frightened. Mm-hmm. And so even though as a counselor, someone who's supposed to look after the children and make sure everything's cool, I think she gets a little unnerved and decides to go to bed.
Yeah.
She as if, okay, I'm hearing things, but maybe it's my imagination, but I still don't want to go over into the woods because it's creepy over there. I'll just go to bed. I'm sure everything's fine.
She retreated back to her tent at about 2 a.m.
Sometime after 2 a.m., and this is based on word from the girls in these other tents, mm-hmm. later on, the flap to tent number 7 is pulled back, and one of the girls was awake. So whoever looked in walked away from that tent and towards tent 8. That girl that was awake, she didn't do anything at the time. She just stayed in the tent.
Well, she said it was the flap was open. Somebody shone a flashlight in there. She might have assumed it was a counselor. She might have not known what it was about.
Yeah, it's hard to know because you would think at 2 a.m. it could be a counselor because maybe the counselor didn't want to wake all of the girls up, didn't even whisper, may not have known the one girl was awake, who knows, but shone the light in, walked away. But this could be a fear thing too, where I'm scared. I don't know who that is. Let's not cause any trouble.
Yeah.
They're going away, so that's a good thing, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Around 3 in the morning, two girls in Cherokee section and one in Quapaw hear a girl scream. The one in Quapaw actually heard mama, mama. Now, they didn't say this at the time. It's not like they hunted down their counselors, as far as I know, and said anything. There was a story that a scout in the camp did report it to a counselor, and they just said, just ignore it.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly, or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
There are some stories about my mom's life that I truly never get tired of hearing. Just in time for Mother's Day, I found the perfect gift that captures all her stories for my family forever. It's called StoryWorth. StoryWorth helps you preserve precious memories and stories from your mom or grandmother for years to come. Each week, StoryWorth emails your loved one a thought-provoking question that you get to help pick. What was your favorite toy as a child? Or what's your favorite memory of your grandmother? All your loved one needs to do is respond to that email with a story. After a year of responses, StoryWorth compiles your loved one's stories and photos into a beautiful keepsake hardcover book. You can even keep a copy of the book for yourself. My mom completed her story, and each of her kids now has a copy to read and share with their kids. Give all the moms in your life a unique, heartfelt gift you'll cherish for years. StoryWorth. Right now, save $10 on your first purchase when you go to StoryWorth.com/GenY. That's StoryWorth.com/GenY to save $10 on your first purchase.
Well, because they're assuming there's another counselor probably closer to the situation. You know, when that counselor would be Carla.
There was a girl that had gotten out of her tent and was wandering around, and they had to see to her, and she was making noise.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have surmised that maybe this girl crying might have been that girl. It's difficult to know.
Yeah, I mean, you got a bunch of kids trying to herd cats here, so things happen. This is probably a regular night at a Girl Scout camp.
At this point, it's starting to get about the time where you think they're all passing out or have passed out by this time, 3 a.m. or later.
Yeah. And anyone that's been camping, you know that the showers that are available at a campsite, if they even have warm water, it's a very limited supply. So early bird gets the worm. If you get to the shower first, you get the warm water. So our camp counselor, Carla, gets up very early at 6 a.m. to hit the showers first. I'm sure it's a little bit more private, and she gets the warm water. And as she's walking to the showers, she notices a sleeping bag at the tree line. And at first she thinks that it's more luggage or equipment or Girl Scouts, you know, sleeping bags that were dropped off. But she thought, well, that's a weird place to put that stuff. It's sort of in the woods. So she walks over to investigate. And that's when she discovers the first body.
Right. And the first body is that of Denise Milner. And she's half nude. It's readily apparent that she's deceased. And there are 2 sleeping bags nearby, of which later a couple of people will actually lift them up.
It's the camp director's husband. Barbara Day is the camp director and her husband, Richard. And Richard goes over and lifts the 2 sleeping bags, trying to see if, you know, if they're just sleeping bags or if there's something inside. And it's pretty apparent once he lifts them up from the weight that there's something inside. And when they open up the 2 sleeping bags, they find the other 2 girls' bodies.
Right. But I believe it's law enforcement that opens the bags.
Yeah.
And I also think that he was just checking the bags.
Mm-hmm.
To see what was going on here, because they have one
dead girl and 2 missing girls.
The first officer to arrive on the scene is Harold Berry, and that's because he lives just down the road. So when help is called for, he's the first one that can respond. He sees the girl and the sleeping bags, and so he, I guess you could say, locks down the scene. Mm-hmm. He watches and makes sure that no one messes with the sleeping bags or the bodies until the sheriff and other investigators can get there. And Sheriff Pete Weaver arrives, I think, by around 7.
Yeah, shortly thereafter.
Now, Sheriff Weaver goes on to say that he thinks he knows when this went down because they know the rain stopped around 11 the previous night, and he found a sash cord that was dry. Everything else is pretty much wet. The sash cord is dry. So he thinks that this evidence was left after the rain had stopped. So he's surmising it happened after 11 and mm-hmm. before 6.
Yeah.
One of the victims, Denise Milner, the one that was out of the sleeping bag, she was about 70 degrees Fahrenheit according to the sheriff. And so that could have been a recent victim. She hadn't been deceased as long as the other two victims who already had signs of rigor mortis.
They found a flashlight by the bodies.
Right. It's one of those box type flashlights.
Big handle on top.
Now, as far as a weapon, because these girls suffered horrible injuries, on scene, they also reported that they found 3 beer bottles and a crowbar nearby.
And it was determined very quickly that they had blunt force trauma to the back of their heads. So
whether the crowbar was used or not, I can't say.
Kind of undetermined if they ever actually found the actual murder weapon in this case. But they found items that they say could have been used.
Now, Denise Milner, she had her hands taped behind her back. She had been gagged. There was what they said was like a sewn gag. Someone had to have sewn it together, and it had been placed in her mouth. Although when they found her, it had come out and was in front of her neck or on the top of her chest. And she had a cord around her neck. Michelle Gousset, her arms were bound to the sides of her body with cord. They think she may have been killed second. And Lori Farmer had no bindings left on her or ever on her. We're not sure. And she was most likely the first victim.
They assume that they were all, or at least two of them, were killed in the tent.
Yeah, there's a real question about Denise because there were signs that possibly she may have been led out of the tent or she could have been carried out of the tent. We're not sure. Everyone ends up at a spot about 100 feet from the tent. So they're moved from the tent.
And there's blood in the tent. So obviously the attack started within the tent. Possibly the two girls that were in the sleeping bags were moved.
Right. The positions of where the girls had been sleeping, it's apparent that both Lori and Michelle had been attacked in the tent. It's difficult to say what happened with Denise, although she was not carried in a sleeping bag the way the other two were.
Yeah.
Or at least we don't think so. But her sleeping bag was out there. She just wasn't in it.
Other items they find are a roll of black duct tape and that flashlight. Now, the flashlight actually had a cover on the lens with a pencil-sized hole as if to obscure the light.
Yeah, it was plastic, and it was used to create a dimmer light, just enough light to see maybe where they needed to go. Because early that morning, it would be really dark out there. And the terrain can get sort of treacherous if you're not moving along the road. Now, they also found a fingerprint on the flashlight. I think it was on the lens.
In the tent where there was blood, they actually found a boot print, what they assume is like a jungle boot, and it's in the blood.
Meanwhile, the OSBI is brought in, which is the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation. I'm not sure the sheriff appreciates them. Now, the staff of the camp, they're freaked out. They have all these girls that aren't going to be able to stay there. So in the meantime, they're going to have the buses pull up so they can take them back to Tulsa. But in the meantime, some of them go hiking. I mean, they give them activities to do until they can get them on the buses. They're not informed that 3 of their campmates have died. Parents are informed that there has been trouble and that they need to go to Tulsa, to Magic Empire headquarters, and await their children who will be showing up on these buses.
And they don't know if their children are going to be on the bus or not.
No, they know something happened. And this part really bothered me, but reports from the victims' families are that they were informed there was an accident. And when they actually have a meeting to have that explained to them, they're told that their child is dead. But they don't find out why or how until they watch the news. It's a frightening scenario because they've lost their child. And one of these girls, her parents' anniversary was the day after her murder. Lori, the youngest one, her birthday was on that Saturday. so her birthday was coming up. She was about to turn 9. Must have been very, very difficult for these families. One of the families was really upset because they found out that they weren't called and informed about what happened to their daughter. Well, not that they were informed about what happened to their daughter, but informed that there was a problem with their daughter until after the director made a couple of other calls, one of them to the insurance company and one to the lawyer. So imagine finding out that your child died at camp and that you weren't notified that there was an issue until after phone calls were made to the insurance and a lawyer. It's like, where's the importance here? Where's the priority? Now, the medical examiner examines all three victims. Milner has been beaten about the head, but her death was asphyxiation due to ligature strangulation. And the cause of death for Michelle Gousset and Lori Farmer was blunt force trauma to the head. Although, according to witnesses, Lori appeared to be relatively undamaged when they looked at her.
Yeah, I think the detective said she appeared to be sleeping, like she could wake up at any moment.
So they test to see if there's any evidence on these bodies. And one of the tests they run because of the state of the bodies is to see if there was
a sexual assault.
If there were sexual assaults. And unfortunately, it looks like at least two of them have been sexually assaulted, maybe all three. But there's a chance that Lori was just killed and the other two were assaulted.
They took swabs from all three of the girls and tested those swabs. And we don't have to go into detail about that. From the swabs, it's pretty definitive that two of them we know were assaulted because they found sperm on those swabs, whereas they did not find it on the third.
That's not the exact language, because as we go through this case, you'll find that the evidence, not just in the collection, but in the examination and in the analysis of that evidence, is some of the worst that you'll find in any case.
Is this Stephen Avery? We just did it too soon.
This, I guess you could say, the only thing it has going for it is this is the 70s. A lot of what we think of as modern forensic techniques, some of those things didn't happen until the 80s. If this case were to have happened in 2000,
it would be definitive who
this would be. We'd have better answers for these descriptions of what the examiner found and what they would tell us.
Yeah.
But in the late 70s,
it's limited, very limited on what they can tell us.
They're limited because of the abilities of the investigators, the abilities of the examiner, the techniques that they're able to use. These are all questionable.
On one of the girls' bindings, there's some tape. This tape happens to have a dark-colored hair on it. So that's taken into evidence, too.
So some of these items that they find, they found came from a nearby farmhouse. In fact, do they arrest this farmer?
Yeah, and they check out the farm. It's a mile west of Camp Scott to the ranch of a 51-year-old man named Jack Schroff. And on his ranch, they find a roll of black duct tape that's remarkably like the tape they find at the scene. And they find some rope. They say that this evidence matches.
So it's rope, cord,
yeah,
light rope. You'll see it mentioned different ways. But he's picked up and he's polygraphed. And this makes the paper.
Yeah.
Unfortunately for him, inside the paper where the story continues, they have a picture of him with the word Slayer on it.
They've already passed judgment on him.
Let's put it this way. Nowadays, we see a lot more of the media coming to people's defense. And at this time, they're actually creating the story and saying, oh, here's the guy that did it. He killed these girls.
Persecuting them before trial.
They're running with the story because, oh, wait, this evidence matches stuff that's found at his home. So he must have been the guy to do this. But what we find out is his home was burglarized. So someone stole items from his property.
I won't say they really vet this farmer, but they give him a polygraph and passes, and they get an alibi from him. They pretty much clear him, and Sheriff Weaver needs a new suspect. So he sets his sight on somebody else who probably be the person we're going to talk about for the rest of this case.
Right. There's a man that he's very familiar with.
Gene Leroy Hart.
Yes. This camp is very large. It's 410 acres. So if you're going to come into the camp not using a car, that's a lot of traveling. So can we come up with reasons why the sheriff thinks of Gene? Because he's broken out of his jail twice. He was in jail because back when he was a young man, football star in his high school, known to be very athletic, very strong, very quick, married and had a child, he abducted two women in Tulsa who were pregnant, put them into the trunk of his car, and drove them out towards the oil refineries. And he raped them, or at least raped one and attempted to rape the other one. So they have him on that. There's a frightening aspect to these rapes, which is when he was done with these women, he taped their faces and he covered them in brush. You could imagine that's him leaving them to die.
Did they report weird noises that he was making?
Right, they did. They said that he started making these low moaning or guttural sounds, and that he seemed incoherent, like someone who you wouldn't be able to reason with. You wouldn't be able to talk to him, like he was in some other mode. And luckily, one of the women was able to break out of her binding. She was able to get free from the tape.
So in 1973, Gene Hart and two other prisoners hacksawed their way out of the Mayors County Jail. And they weren't really hunted down. They weren't really actively looking for him, a known rapist. I'm sure they hunted him for probably a week or so after he broke out. But after that, yeah, I guess they just assumed through attrition or pulling people over, they might just get him.
You're talking about the second breakout.
Yeah.
The first breakout, he was caught relatively quickly. So when he got busted on the rapes, he was put away. And then he's paroled, and then he commits a series of robberies. So he's returned to jail, but since he broke his parole by committing these robberies, they give him some astronomical number of years as a sentence.
It's a life sentence.
And then that's when he has his breakouts. His first breakout, he gets away, but both he and his buddy are found relatively quickly.
Yeah.
Then the second breakout that you've described, he's just gone.
Yeah.
And it's because of where he's at. He's a Native American, and he has a lot of support. If you read through and hear some of these things that are said about him, there were people saying, oh, he didn't rape and abduct those women. They wanted to get away from their husbands, so they went off with him. They liked him. This isn't just your normal criminal. This is a guy who is loved by the people in that area, or at least respected. Or they have loyalty to him for some reason. So he can go and stay at different places and evade the law enforcement that way.
He's got a support group in the tribes and the reservations. And
he's Cherokee.
Populous there.
He parted ways with his wife and son after the rapes. She divorced him, and he never had any dealings with them again.
Sheriff Weaver thinks he'd be a prime candidate for somebody that committed this act, right?
Right. He's a rapist. He's a thief.
And a fugitive on the run.
And a fugitive on the run. And what do they have going on in this case? Those same three features. Now, his mother lives very close to Camp Scott. How close?
A mile?
About a mile.
Yeah.
So at this point, I think everyone can agree Sheriff Weaver sounds like he knows what he's doing.
Yeah, it sounds like a viable suspect. And Locust Grove natives spotted a man resembling Hart running from a cave near the camp. And they say that he was armed with a shotgun and a rifle and other items that Jack from the farm claimed were stolen from him. So another witness to Hart being in the general vicinity. Two brothers, the Thompson brothers, are out squirrel hunting, and they come across a cave that looks lived in, and they investigate it. They go inside, and they find photographs, a plastic cover, what appears to be a plastic cover to a flashlight, and some other items like eyeglasses and stuff that are in this cave. They're assuming that Hart was the resident of this cave, and it was one of his many hideouts or homes that he would live in.
Well, one of the items is a newspaper, right?
Yeah.
And they look at the date of this newspaper and which paper it is. Well, inside the boxy flashlight was newspaper. And they say that if your flashlight's not making good contact with the battery, you can actually put the paper in there and it will help connect.
Yeah, push the battery against the connectors.
Right. So
kind of like putting newspaper in your shoe.
The newspaper inside the flashlight is from the same paper, same date, same edition as that found in the cave.
So looking like Hart's a really good suspect now.
The photographs, they published them in the papers. And what they ended up finding out was that while Hart was in prison, he helped, what was it, a guard who worked there?
Yeah, a jailer.
Who moonlighted as a wedding photographer. He helped him develop pictures. And these photos came from those developing sessions.
Now we have a jailer who was working with Hart, and these are photos that they did together, and he's in possession of them. Who else would have these photos living in a cave next to Camp Scott?
They end up checking out a few caves. One of them isn't even really a cave, but they call it a cave. It's more like where rocks meet or something. Mm-hmm. And at that spot, they see some graffiti.
It says, what, the real killer was here.
And it gives a date.
1977, and then...
Well, it's... The date is weird, because normally, if it was you or I, we would write 4/17/77.
Mm, the month, day, and the year.
So describe this rock, because there's graffiti on it.
It says, 77/6/17, the killer was here, bye-bye, fools. And that's kind of a weird way to write a date with the year first.
Right. They say it's consistent with how a military person would take down a date.
Yeah. I would concur with that, being a ex-military person.
So this is another clue that they feel is tied to the case, because these quote-unquote caves are not that far
from each other or from the campsite.
They're near enough that they could see it as being a launching point for the attacker to go from the cave to the campsite and then hike all the way back to the cave.
You know, when I saw the writing in the cave, I thought it was a little weird, because I didn't think Hart was ex-military. Didn't really think much about it. I thought maybe it was a prank of some kind.
And that's what we don't know. We don't know if someone decided to write something and it's just accepted as being from the killer.
Yeah. The camp, something we didn't mention, was the camp actually received threatening letters. They had items missing or stolen before the murders happened. Some of the items that were stolen were eyeglasses and just miscellaneous objects. And the threatening letter said, four girls will be murdered at your campsite. And this was disregarded as a prank.
Well, maybe. The note that you're talking about, there's no record of it because a counselor threw it away. So do we accept that there really was such a note?
It's exactly. I mean, we know the writing's on the wall there, but we don't know who wrote it. And there was a note that this counselor claims happened, and they say that items are missing.
We have a picture of the rock with the graffiti on it. The note apparently was inside of a donut box. Am I right?
Yeah, some donuts were missing.
So a woman's boyfriend brought the donuts, but then when they went to open the box, there were no donuts, but there was this note. And apparently the note also referenced aliens.
It was a wacky note.
Right. Now, another thing that happened prior to the camp officially opening was there was a tent found with a slash in it that they say looks like someone cut it. We're not sure if that's really necessarily tied into the crimes because none of these girls was attacked with a knife. The most important thing I heard was that one of the mothers of one of the victims said if she had seen the way this Kiowa camp was set up and where Tent 8 was prior to the girls going, she would never have let her daughter go there because she said she herself wouldn't have stayed in that tent. It was too remote. It was too off on its own.
Mm-hmm. So back to the hunt for Hart. They find these caves. They've collected items from these caves. And they have boots on the ground searching and hunting for this guy. And they have an informant that they're working with. And the investigator, Harvey Pratt, who is actually a Native American himself and on the OSBI team. This informant, I guess, gives them information that Hart is staying at a man's house named Pigeon.
And there's a lot of talk about who this informant is. They don't want to give up the person, supposedly, but it's said that they put pressure on a Cherokee woman and that...
They threatened her with incarceration and other things.
Well, and they also... Well, they threatened her also with the fathers of these victims want justice. And if they can't get the real killer, if they know the name of someone and their location who knows who the killer is, then, oh, maybe they'll get that information because we need to give them something soon. We can't keep stringing these people along. They need answers. So it was that pressure idea of, oh, the fathers are going to come out here and they're going to meet me and they're going to come after me. Denise's father is a police officer.
Yeah.
But they also had assistance from one of Gene's breakout partners. His name is Larry Gene Dry, and he escaped with Hart. He told the authorities that Hart was interested in young girls, and that at one point he actually had to use a shotgun on him, you know, pointed at him, threaten Hart, don't do this, because Hart wanted to rape these two girls that were swimming.
Just some weird isolated incident that he talks about, but we don't know if it actually happened or not.
No, we don't. Now, Larry Gene Dry, he had his own issues. I got the sense that he was willing to say whatever it took because he wanted to cut a deal.
Because he's escaped from prison also, along with Hart, so he's facing some major punishment.
And there was talk that the governor was going to pardon if he helped with the investigation.
Mm-hmm.
The governor's aide had to actually come out and talk to the media because there's all these rumors flying around. And he said, yes, the governor okayed his leave. So he got to leave prison, but he had nothing to do with the parole. Now get this. He is paroled on May 18th, 1978. He was recommended for parole by the board 20 days after Gene Hart is captured.
Mm-hmm.
They track him down. He's staying with an elderly Cherokee man.
Medicine man, I think.
Named Sam Pigeon. And Sam calls Gene Drum. And this man does not like to speak English. I don't know if it's because he can't.
He's
or
old.
If he just has a real preference to speak his own language.
Yeah, his native tongue. And during this time, this hunt, Gene's actually got a following already. People are already saying he didn't do this and you got the wrong guy, and has a built-in support before he's even arrested because he's eluding the police and he's becoming a folk hero.
They go to get Hart and he actually peeks out of this, what's described as a tar and paper shack.
Yeah, it's just a little hut thing.
It has three rooms, which probably makes it sound larger than it actually is, but he's told to stop. That they have him surrounded. He ducks into the place and attempts to go out the other way. But by this time, agents are already coming in.
They got the place surrounded.
And he's asked, do you want to die today? Hart gives up.
Yeah.
The only thing he says to these law enforcement officers is a response. And he is asked, you killed those girls, didn't you?
He says, you'll never pin it on me.
That's what the law enforcement officers say.
Yeah.
Because after that, Hart says nothing.
Well, unless it's a press conference.
Right. But he's not going to say anything to officers. He's not giving any information, nothing incriminating. Before they take him away, agents pose for pictures with him as if he's a trophy.
So they search this place where they apprehend him from. They don't find anything.
They get a second search warrant.
Mm-hmm.
They search the place again. That's when they find
the pipe, corncob, toy pipe, and
a mirror,
other things that they say are stolen items from Camp Scott. And between Hart having items from the campsite, the cave having items that and tie him to it, here they have, they're building this case against him.
Well, Sam Pigeon says that those items were never there before.
The pipe and the mirror and stuff.
Those items that they claim are evidence that he had taken things from the camp, Sam Pigeon says were never there before. He says they're planted evidence. And to give you an idea where he was hiding out at, he was in Cookson Hills. That's where this tar and paper shack is. It's about 50 miles from Camp Scott. So it's a little ways away.
Yeah, yeah.
And they discover that he'd been there for 8 months.
Interesting.
Sam Pigeon would head off.
Yeah.
At like 6 in the morning and come back at like 6 in the evening or something like that. And while he was gone, Hart would work. He would take care of things. And Sam was really happy with the arrangement.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better. Notice things like your hair and your nails feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY.
We have items that are allegedly planted, not found on the first search, but second search. Sounds a lot like the Stephen Avery case.
Sheriff Weaver is a controversial figure.
What's his history?
He works out of the Mays Jail. They had a man die in their custody before, which seemed very suspicious. And they also had some men beaten one day. And when he came under fire for that, he said, no one's going to tell me how to run my jail. Someone that worked at the jail said that those photographs had been taken by the sheriff and put in his desk the first time they captured him. And think about it. Would Gene really run around all these years with those two pictures?
And if he dropped them in this cave and they were there for any length of time, weather and elements could have disintegrated them.
They were sort of crumpled, from what I understand.
But they were in good condition, though.
Oh, yeah. They were able to run copies of them in the papers.
I didn't think they were that crumpled. I mean, they look maybe a little, but yeah. These are photos that Gene could have had in prison because of the jailer that he worked with. We're going to assume that he escapes prison with these photos on him and then leaves them in this cave.
Right. Someone suggested that one of the pictures, the woman in it, looked like his ex-wife.
Okay.
I don't know how much he was in love with that woman. And beyond that, that's just someone's interpretation.
Yeah.
And why would he have two pictures if only one of them resembled his? What about the other one?
Yeah. Like, what's the point of having this photo?
Yeah, they said they're not risque photos or anything.
No, I saw the photos and it's kind of weird. Like, why would he even have these? But Sheriff Weaver says he has a signed property receipt. Sheriff Weaver says, no, he was in possession of these photos, not I.
But some would say that's exactly the kind of document that he can just come up with.
And some would say, why would he have these photos? I mean, it's one of those things where he's in a cell. I don't know what personal items he is allotted or not allotted. Like, how did he come to have these photos? Why would he have them? Why would they allow him to have them? Why wouldn't Weaver be in possession of these? It's just an argument. You could go back and forth all day about it. But the whole point of it is these photos and these other items from the cave tie him to the murder scene.
Do they?
That's the argument here.
They tie him to the cave, maybe. Yeah.
But remember, at the cave, they found the newspaper, correct?
Right.
And the newspaper was also found in the flashlight, and there was plastic covering that they say could have been used with that same flashlight. Then they find items from this shack that tie him to the campsite. So two tie-ins here that they're working with. A jailer says he saw these items, or she saw these items, in Weaver's desk, and she actually testifies to that, correct?
It becomes he said, she said. There's nothing definitive here.
Yeah.
So he's prosecuted.
Mm-hmm.
Taken to trial, and of course he needs lawyers, and he gets offers from some very prominent attorneys from the time, but he doesn't choose them. And I'm not sure why. It's not really explained, is it? Other than when he does decide on a lawyer, he has support from the community and they raise money to help pay for his fight to get out of this trouble. People are all saying he didn't do this.
There's crowds of people around the courthouse during the trial that are all pro Hart supporters, all these advocates, and the victims' families have to be escorted in and out of the courthouse under police guard because they are treated so poorly by these protesters and these advocates. I didn't care to hear about that, but it happened. You know, when the press would show up, he gave a couple press conferences before the trial. Wow, you get to tell the public you're innocent before the trial even starts. They were even shirts made that said, Hartford District Attorney.
We don't really want to bore you with particulars of the trial. There's a couple reasons for that. One, it would take a while to kind of explain everything that happens. We need to say that the defense had a strategy here, which was to point out that you can say this is part of that, and that's part of this, and this. It's sort of this long, linking narrative that they have to try and tie him to these crimes. But they're all tentative. They're all like, well, it's this paper with that that's in the flashlight, and the flashlight came from over here. But they find a fingerprint on the flashlight, but it doesn't match his.
They find that bloody footprint, but it's the wrong size.
Yeah, it's like a shoe print, but it's a size or two too small.
Yeah, and I've seen different sizes listed. The last one I saw was Hartwear is an 11.5, and the size print that they found in the tent was a 10. But I've seen size 7s and size 9s, so I'm not going to commit to any of those sizes. Let's just say that Hart's foot was too big. You know, the shoe size was way too big, or the footprint, the bloody footprint, was way too small for Hart's.
The crime scene was not handled properly. We know this because there was testimony that an officer looked in there, he left, when he came back, it looked different. What does that tell you? Yeah. When they actually checked out some of these prints, some of these fingerprints, some of the shoe prints or boot prints associated with officers that had been there.
What kind of shoes do most law enforcement wear? Boots. Now, I'm just speculating here. I want to make that clear, but they say that they vetted this bloody footprint and compared it to all the officers there, but did they?
The defense can attack all of the evidence rather easily in this case. They not only do that, but then they frustrate the prosecutor. They file all kinds of
motions
that they have to respond to, which takes away from their ability to investigate. They just drive him crazy. So as the trial goes on, it's very clear that the jury is seeing this and seeing how there are all these doubts. The actual real evidence talking about shoe prints or fingerprints do not link him at all.
Yeah.
And the evidence collected from the girls of the sexual assault is not definitive enough. It can be called into question.
Remember the hair. They compare the one black hair they found on the tape to Hart's hair, and they say it's a match. But then the defense comes back and says, no, it's only similar. Therefore, anyone with black hair could have a very similar profile. Also, the swab samples they took from the girls, they say Hart had a vasectomy. So therefore, he couldn't have left any of that. Meanwhile, they find out that his operation was not a success, and they compare his sperm to what was found at the crime scene. And again, all they can say is it's type O blood, secretor. It doesn't match the other suspects, but it does look very similar to Gene Hart's. Very similar. Not a match. Here it is. Does it exclude him? No. Does it absolutely point to him? Not really. The fingerprint and the bloody shoe print absolutely do not point to him. But here you could say he attacked these girls with another person, or there was multiple attackers here and not just Hart acting alone, which would make sense to me because I don't know how he could have pulled this off by himself. I don't know how he could have attacked three girls unless he murdered one and had the other two comply because of that or something, but it would just seem a lot to manage by himself. So that's the prosecution's case here is a similar hair, similar specimens collected, flashlight, and other things, all tying him back to the scene. And the defense shows, well, this evidence could have been planted, and none of this is definitive. All of it is circumstantial. The jury spends less than a day deliberating. Gene Hart is found not guilty. Hart, who has escaped prison twice and needs to fulfill his term, he goes back to prison and dies from a cardiac arrest. There is some mystery around his death saying cyanide was collected from inmates the day before or something, but I'm just going to assume the guy was jogging in the yard and died from a heart attack.
Well, some of that probably comes from the sheriff who hinted that the other inmates took care of him.
Yeah.
But the actual medical examiner that did the autopsy said it was a massive heart attack.
So here we have yet another case where a man is accused of a horrible crime and the people in charge of investigating and prosecuting him don't seem to be the squeaky clean people we want, especially when it comes to Sheriff Weaver, who has pretty bad record, just like Gene. I mean, there's nobody in the story I really like. That's the problem here is when Gene walks free for this crime, the victim's families are in utter disbelief. And between OSBI, prosecutor, and sheriff's department, they thought they had a airtight case, and they didn't. Why do you think that?
I think they thought people could connect the dots here, but they failed to recognize, one, that many in the community saw this as a witch hunt, and they were suspicious about this evidence that was supposedly collected, And think about what kind of evidence it is. If you think about all the items they pinned on him, the only things that make sense are the glasses.
Yeah.
Jean Hart would wear women's glasses. There's a number of reasons for it, probably, but he would just try them on when he was robbing or when he raped those women early on in his criminal career. He would try on their glasses. There were glasses missing from the camp.
Now, did he have poor eyesight? Was that ever determined?
Well, yes, he needed glasses.
Okay.
And I think the prosecution was like, well, there are these glasses, but then there's also the corncob pipe. There's the photographs. There are all these different items that don't make any sense. Why would he have these things?
Yeah.
If you're going to steal stuff, why would you take rinky-dink stuff? It doesn't make a lot of sense. And then why couldn't they have found it the first time they searched? This is a poor little tiny shack. And they didn't find it. It's not like they dug up the floor and then found it.
Or behind the pair of shoes by the bookshelf.
It wasn't anything like that.
It was out in the open.
So it's very, very curious. When it comes down to it, the DNA evidence wasn't really there. The sperm comparison evidence, it's an analysis. It can be done wrong.
But it doesn't exclude him. And people,
no, it doesn't exclude him.
People like to point out, oh, well, you got it down to 0.00 blah, blah, blah of the population. Well, I'm thinking type O. A lot of people are type O blood, not type O positive or negative. This is just they only went so far as to find out blood type, not the subtype, and a black hair. When I first started looking into this, I thought, well, all they've really nailed it down to is it probably was a Native American. But then it could have just been anyone that's type O secretor with black hair. Doesn't have to be a Native American anymore. It's pretty general now. And even if it is a Native American, well, that whole area is fairly populated by Native Americans. So I don't care how finite of the population fits this profile. It could be one in, you know, whatever thousand people. Well, how many Native Americans live there? Could have been any of them then. It doesn't mean it was Hart.
Well, one of the other suspects that comes up, and in this trial, they are allowed to present evidence for another suspect. The defense is they have testimony from Joyce Payne and her son, Larry Short, and they both claim that a man named Bill Stevens visited their home the very morning that the Girl Scouts were discovered dead, and that he had scratches around his neck and on his arms, and his boots were stained red, and they loaned him a flashlight that looks just like the one they found. So here's the crazy part, is they end up charging these two with perjury, and they end up dropping charges against Larry, but Joyce pleads no contest. Bill Stevens' dad says, I was with him all weekend. There's some witness testimony that places him somewhere, and they're like, you're lying to us. And in the end, Joyce gives up. She says, it's nolo contendere or something, but it's no contest.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many ways to look at this case, and everybody will say, oh, it was one guy. It was two guys. It was three guys. It was kids from another camp. It was, and they'll go down the list of all these things. But I guess one thing that I've discovered in this case is that the evidence is very, very shaky because they didn't have a lockdown on all these scenes.
No.
As soon as they're discovered, they're not locked down. The only time anything was really locked down was the bodies. When they first find those bodies, you can put Barry there and, you know, Officer Trollman Barry, he is watching over the bodies. He's making sure they're not messed with. But even before he got there, people were poking at him.
Yeah.
There's not enough evidence here for me to be able to sit down and tell everyone, here's what I think happened. I think it's that much of a mess.
Anytime you think, okay, well, you know, they just let a guilty man walk free. Well, it's because the investigation, the sheriff's reputation, and the prosecution did not prove their case. And I don't think they proved it in this at all. And I personally think that Hart should have been the prime suspect, but I don't think they had a case against him. Because when you can get somebody to testify, like the jailer, and say, no, I saw this stuff in the sheriff's desk before it was discovered at the scene, that's very damning.
The items they found in that tar and paper shack, they had taken into evidence a trunk from one of the counselors that had those items in it. You know what I mean? So yeah. It's odd that there's this idea that they may have had this evidence and then just dropped it off.
It's different from the previous case we just covered because you have people testifying that this was put there. I saw it beforehand and now it's here. This is bad. That's on law enforcement there. That's on them. They need to, you know, cross their T's and dot their I's. They need to have a good reputation because when you have a distrust, all you got to do is insinuate this is planted and people are going to believe it. In this case, they absolutely did believe it. I fault law enforcement in this one. They should have handled it better. The prosecutor didn't have enough to work with here.
There is one thing I want to say, though, before I finish, which is the girls were moved about 100 feet from their tent. And if you look at the layout of the area, and I'm not saying this has to be the case, but I almost feel as though there were plans to take them away off the property.
Yeah, that was so weird.
The flashlight was dropped because he may have been interrupted. He or they were interrupted, whoever they were.
I would believe that there had to have been multiple because I don't see one person dragging off two or three bodies, moving them. I mean, if they were taking them with them, that one person's not doing that.
I tend to think two, and again, I don't know there's enough information, but I tend to think two because Denise had her hands taped behind her back. She had been gagged, and she had a cord around her neck. Michelle Gousset, her arms were bound to the sides of her body with cord, and Lori Farmer had no bindings left on her. Two of the girls were much more molested than the third.
Yeah.
And so I almost wonder if one was silenced and then the other two were attacked separately. Denise was taken away from the tent to be attacked outside of the tent a little ways away. And then perhaps they thought they should just take the evidence with them. The ground inside the tent was wiped up with sheets. And then those sheets were stuffed into the sleeping bags. So it's almost like they were trying to take a lot of the evidence with them.
To cover the crime.
To really make this difficult to solve. But again, it's just such a mess that I don't think this is ever going to be solved. I think it's impossible. And even as late as last year, in 2014, the OSBI announced that they were winding down their investigation that they had renewed. And I've searched and searched, and I can't see a follow-up to those posts.
No. They actually did do a DNA analysis in, 2012? It was more recent. And the DNA they collected, it all had disintegrated. It wasn't usable. So it was inconclusive. Some people say, they got three of the 4 points or something, but it's not enough to definitively say this came from this person. Again, it doesn't exclude Hart, but you could say the bloody footprint excludes him.
As does the fingerprint on the flashlight. Because it didn't match Hart's fingerprint.
But all the other evidence doesn't exclude him.
This will always remain a mystery, then, perhaps.
Yeah.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.